I'm Holly Alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I'm really, really honored and excited to be here tonight. I want to thank John and Kathy and the committee for having me. It was an awesome drive up. I'm a road warrior. I love to travel. You'll hear a little bit about that in a minute. Used to do it with my thumb. Now I actually drive a car. But Atlanta's just awesome. I come up here a lot. I visit Atlanta a lot. I was just up here for the Woodstock of AA at Lake Lanier. You know, I just love the area. Yahoo! So thank you. Thank you so much for having me. So it's my job, I think, to tell you a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like tonight, what it's like now. I have kind of two stories and a lot, and really two really important spiritual experiences that I really hope that I'll get to communicate to you guys. My sobriety date is September 28th, 1996, but I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous and got sober originally on February 3rd, 1981. I was sober for 13 and a half years. I went out for a year and a half and came right back in, and that was September 28th, 1996. So I've been been working on this for like my whole adult life. I'm 58 years old today. I was 23 when I first came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to kind of try to paint a picture for you guys of what I looked like when I got here and what was going on in my mind when I got here. And the only way that I can do that is go all the way back to my childhood. So, because there were a couple of very significant things when I was a kid that kind of formulated my opinion about myself, and I know everybody's going, yes, because we all have that. So I'm going to share mine. I was raised in Libertyville, Illinois. I know you don't hear much of that Yankee accent anymore, but a little bit there. I was raised in Libertyville, Illinois. Libertyville is a little tiny town. It's about 30 miles north of Chicago. Very, very small little town. Population was about 10,000. My dad at the time was a prominent surgeon in the community. And we had a beautiful home out on St. Mary's Drive. Robert Louis Stevenson Jr. lived right down the street. Beautiful ranch home, kind of had the circular driveway, you know, where you come in and there's land, you know, here and woods, and you come in and you go in front of the house, and then to go out, you go back out that way. Lovely home. And it all looked really good, except for one small minor detail. My dad, and he's the only man I ever called daddy in my life, and I did find out years later that he wasn't actually my dad. There'd actually been another one before him, but he wasn't ever in the picture, and so I didn't learn about him until many years later. So this was the man I called daddy. He married my mom when I was about two. Well, he was a prominent surgeon in the community, and he was also a mainline amphetamine user. And for those of you who don't know what that means he got the good stuff and he shot it up. So he did amphetamines, you know, like all the time. And then on the weekends, he would go into the bathroom and he would drink pure grain alcohol and stay in there for the weekend and come off so that he could do surgery on Monday. Glad he wasn't my doctor. whew, little scary. So I want to kind of tell you what it was like living with my daddy, because I was my daddy's confidant. I was his best friend. I will tell you that I have a very, very finite, very acute memory. I remember going all the way back to 6 months old. I have a very, very, very vivid memory. I also had really long blackouts. I used to come out of blackouts in relationships. So, you know, like, really long blackouts. And I really did. I'm not even kidding. so I guess that was a balance in the brain there. I don't know. But I will also tell you that when I was a child, I never experienced being a child. And what I mean by that is I remember being 2 years old. I ran away from home the first time when I was two. I remember being two and three and four and 5 years old. But if you were coming from my side, you know, looking out here, my memories are I was an adult. I was an equal with my parents. There was never a hierarchy in my household. And that's because my daddy and I were very, very close. He taught me how to put cups up to the wall and listen in the walls for bugs. And he taught me what G-men drive, the kind of cars G-men drive. He taught me that I needed to be watching for G-men all the time. He taught me what they wore. G-men wear black suits with black hats. You know, when I saw the Untouchables years later, I was like, oh my God, that's them. So you know, what I know today that I didn't know then is apparently amphetamine use, you know, especially when you're, you know, like doing really good amphetamines on a regular basis, it creates a bit of paranoia. But I didn't understand that that's what was going on then. I thought it was real. I thought, you know, I was watching out for him. You know, I was watching for G-men and, you know, it was like, are they there? You know, I don't know. Is that one daddy? You know, just kind of watching for them. It was my job to protect him. I had his back. That was my job. I was, you know, his wingman, for no better term. I was really the person that managed daddy. Now, my mother is an alcoholic. She's a sober alcoholic today. She's self-professed, so I can say she's an alcoholic. But at the time, she was a practicing alcoholic. And the way that my mother dealt with daddy was my mother would drink. She would sit in the corner. She would cry. My mom was pretty much useless. She really didn't really know how to manage him. So it was really my job to manage him. I would talk him down. He would get a little crazy. You know, things like he would drive through the circular driveway in his convertible Cadillac, and he would just start shooting up the front of the house, and bullets would come in through the dining room window. We'd all hit the floor. Well, there goes daddy again. We would go grocery shopping, and we would come home from grocery shopping, and I always opened the door first, the front door, when my mom kind of waited and got groceries, and I would open the front door, and on occasion, he'd have a tripod set up at the front door, and he would have handguns attached to the tripod, and he would have strings around the trigger, and he would be around the corner holding the strings laughing. And, you know, you would open the front door and go, "Mom, not today." Close the front door, go back out, and go, "Mom, you know, we need to go to a hotel. You know, we need to go somewhere." "Okay, woo-hoo-hoo-hoo," you know, get in the car and off we go. So that's sort of how it was. So needless to say, my life is a little bit exciting, just a little, and not that I like adrenaline today, but it definitely formed a bit of a pattern in that area. He did teach me how to shoot guns, used to try to aim at the neighbor's animals, which, you know, I'm really an animal activist today, so that was probably not good, but hopefully I didn't hit any that I can remember. But he felt like it was really important that I knew how to handle a handgun, you know, because the G-men might come and, you know, I don't know, but I had to learn that. He did take me out driving, which I thought was why I like road trips to this day. He had a little Corvette, and we would drive up in the hills of Wisconsin, and he'd set me on his lap and just let me drive, and it'd be like, "Wee!" And I'd go off into the woods and off, and he just laughed and thought it was all hilarious. And when I was about 5, I start kindergarten. And everything kind of changes when you start entering into a world with other people. So I am still managing daddy at home. And then I go to school and I'm now a kindergartner. And I remember kindergarten very, very vividly. And the reason I did is because I didn't really relate to the other children. And as I can imagine, most other children are not driving Corvettes and shooting handguns and watching for G-men. So I really didn't fit in very well. They had conversations like, you know, what cartoon were they watching? And, you know, their conversations, I didn't relate to at all, not at all. But I wanted to relate to them. You know, I wanted to fit in. And so I would pretend, I would try to make up conversations that seemed like the kind of conversations that other 5-year-olds would have. At home, my parents entertained a lot. They had a lot of social gatherings, I guess, because he was, you know, the big surgeon in town. And so they would have cocktail parties. So when I'm 5 and I'm in kindergarten, I'm really starting to feel very, very, I don't fit in anywhere. You know, I don't think other kids have the same relationship with their parents that I do, and I don't relate to the other kids. And at one particular cocktail party, and here's the thing, when my parents had parties, when my parents entertained other adults, they treated me differently. They didn't treat me the same, and I didn't like it. I felt very rejected, very abandoned whenever they would have a cocktail party. Well, my mom, she was pretty much a non-entity anyway, you know, with the hoo-hoo-hoo in the corner all the time. But, you know, my daddy didn't treat me the same way when there were other adults there. And, you know, they were up here, and I was down here. But they did feel like by the time I was 5, it was time for me to learn how to start serving drinks at their cocktail parties. So they did teach me how to make a martini. And I'll never forget this forever. But they taught me how to make my mom's martini. My mom drank martinis in big glasses, and pretty much they were just vodka, but they called it a martini. I guess it just looked better. But pour a bunch of vodka in the glass, mom's happy. And so I was walking across the room at the cocktail party, and I'm down here, and they're up there, and I'm feeling rejected and abandoned, and I don't fit in anywhere, and life is just generally confusing to me. And I'm walking across the room with this big glass, and I remember it being a very big glass, and I don't know if it was or it's because I was 5, but, you know, it seemed like a big glass to me. And I took a big sip of the drink. And I'm a gulper. I've always been a gulper. If you hand me a bottle of water, I'll take a sip and half the bottle will be gone. That's just the way I drink. And I don't think I changed ever in my life. So I know I probably took a pretty big hit on that vodka. And I'll never forget it. You know, I'm five. And I take a huge swig of straight vodka. And it was wonderful. It burned, but it was a good burn, you know, like a good burn. And I'm sure I went, wow, and I took a few more sips. And something crazy happened to me. You ever see the movie Wizard of Oz? And you know how it's all black and white? And then the house crashes. And Dorothy goes, oh, and she goes to the door. And she swings it open. And she looks out, and everything's in color. That's exactly what happened when I had that big swig of vodka. All of a sudden, everything in the room changed. All of a sudden, I fit in. I even know what dress I had on. It was my little brown dress, and it had little stars on it, little white stars, and it swirled. You know, swirly dresses? And it was like, wow, I felt pretty. I felt a part of. I felt like I could talk to the other adults, and they all got me. You know, it was just one with the room. I felt love for the very first time in my life. Absolutely, that's what it felt like. That thing everybody had always kind of talked about and felt, and you see it in movies and you read it in fairy tales. Love. And I'm here to tell you that I am not an alcoholic, that drank to escape in my life. I have always drank to chase that elusive feeling of love. That is all I've ever wanted. You know, there's a line in the Big Book that so resonates with me, and it's, we're tortured by loneliness. And I used to say that, tortured by loneliness, and it would make me cry. It would bring tears to my eyes, because those aren't just words on paper. Those are words coming out of my soul. I was tortured by loneliness until I took a sip of vodka. Now, alcohol was very open and prevalent in my home. It was no big deal for us as children. Well, I have a younger sister. She's 4 years younger than I am. So probably she didn't have much to drink then, but it wasn't unusual to have wine at dinner, and I was 5 or 6 or 7. I was allowed to have that. It was no big deal. My mom might be watching a TV show, and if I want a glass of beer, I can have a glass of beer. So I started drinking pretty regularly from that point on, from 5 years old on. When I was 7 years old, my dad had a particular incident one night where he was just going crazy and ripping phones off the wall and kind of doing his usual thing. And when he would do that kind of thing, it was my job to calm him down. This particular night, I left. I went out a bedroom window, I went to a neighbor's, and we called the police because he was just crazy. And I have to tell you that for years, I never really understood why that night. I mean, he always did that. I mean, he wouldn't hurt me. I know he wouldn't hurt me. I mean, to this day, I will tell you that my experience was I was never afraid of that man, ever. I probably should have been, but I wasn't. I thought I was, you know, I was his buddy. He would never hurt me. And he didn't hurt us. I mean, he didn't physically, I mean, other than shooting guns at us, but, you know, that doesn't count. whoops, just duck, you'll be fine. But, you know, he never, like hit us, you know, or anything like that. So I never really understood why, but that night, for whatever reason, I decided to go out and go to the neighbors and call the police, and I remember it. I remember leaving. I remember feeling very powerful and going to the neighbors and calling the police, and they came, and they took him away, and they took him to places where they used to take surgeons back in those days, and it wasn't jail, I promise you. It was some little dry-out place for doctors, and that's where they took him. But he didn't come back. What happened was my mother divorced him while he was away, and we moved into another house in Libertyville. And I, at this time, have a little sister. And I did find out, and I want to share this with you. I found out about 4 months ago. Now, I'm 58 years old. This happened when I was 7, okay? I found out about 4 months ago. I was speaking somewhere, and my mom found out. And my mom said, asked me if she could come and hear my story. And I said, no, absolutely not. No. And I said, Mama, no, you can't come. You can't come because I'm going to talk about Dr. Tuthill, and I'm going to talk about Mr. B., which we'll get to in a minute. And you're not gonna, it's gonna hurt you. It's gonna hurt you. You're gonna take it on and you know, I don't want you to hear it. And she said to me, you know, that night, like out of the blue, she says this, right? You know that night, he was holding a gun to your sister's head. Now, you know, I don't remember that. I absolutely don't remember that, but apparently that is why that night I went out the window and went to the neighbors and called the police. So this is what happens. This is the consequence of me doing that. They get divorced. He gets out of wherever he is, and it's time to come visit the children. Well, now I'm not his. I didn't know that. Nobody ever mentioned some other daddy. You know, it's like that was daddy. But my sister is. So what happens is I'm all excited. He's coming. I put on my favorite little dress, and I sit in front of the window, and I wait all day Friday for him to arrive. And he pulls into the driveway, and he walks into the house, and he picks up my sister, and he walks out of the house, and he doesn't say a word to me. And he did not say a word to me for 20 years. Not a word. Not a word. Yeah, you don't rat out an amphetamine user and get away with it. And that's what I had done. I mean, he's still using. You know, he's still crazy. And he was pretty much like that and practiced medicine until he died. I will tell you that 20 years later, I was sober. And my sister was coming to visit me. And he actually called my house. And he was asking for my sister. And I answered the phone. And I knew him. I knew it was him immediately. I hadn't heard his voice. I mean, I've heard his voice because he, you know, talked to my sister. But he'd never spoken to me directly. And he said, you know, this is Dr. Tuttle. And I said, I know. And I was freaked out. You know, like one of those phone calls where you go, oh, my God. And he asked for my sister. And I said she wasn't there yet. And could I take a message? And he said, yeah. And then he goes, is this Holly? And I'm like, yes, sir. And he said, I just want you to know that I've heard you're doing really well. And I said, thank you. Because like I said, I was sober at the time. And he said, we'll have her call. And he hung up. And he died the next year. So I was very grateful that I got that, you know, two sentence or whatever after 20 years of, you know, no communication. So mom gets divorced. He's gone out of my life. He's visiting my sister regularly. My sister goes with him. My sister does summers. My sister does Christmas. My sister does everything with daddy. But he's not in my life anymore. I trip over a picture at my grandmother's house when I'm about 9 or 10 years old, and there's some man, and I say, Grandma, who's this man? And she says, oh, that's your dad. That's how I found out I had another one. you know, nobody bothered to mention it, but he was never in my life. My mother stayed single for many, many years, from 7 to when I was 13. I'm still in Libertyville. I'm drinking regularly. I had my first alcoholic convulsion at 12, but mom just said, oh, honey, and wiped up the vomit and put me in bed. I mean, you know, it's just like not a big deal. A lot of drinking going on in my house. I was a straight-A student. I was a complete geek. If anybody knows what Gumby looks like, that was me. I had short, frizzy hair because my mother did a lilt perm. Oh, my God. If anybody remembers lilt perms. Oh, so I had hair, and I have sort of big lips, and it was Chicago, so it was cold, and I would chap from the bottom of my nose all the way around my chin. You know, this would all be red and chapped and crusty and lilt perm, and I looked like Gumby. So I wasn't real popular in school, but I did make straight A's. When I was in eighth grade, when I was 13, my mother married the shop teacher, Mr. B. Now, Mr. B was 23, my mom was 33, and I was 13. Now, I will tell you now there was no sexual abuse. I like to just get that out of the way right now. But Mr. B was raised in a German farming town in Missouri called Argyle, Missouri, population 99, where the men are served food first, while the women eat in the kitchen later, after the men have been served and gone off to the fields. Maybe some of you go, oh, yeah, but I went, what? Are you kidding me? You know, I've never seen anything like that in my life. He believed that children should be seen and not heard. Really? I didn't understand that either. I mean, come on, I managed my first daddy. You know, and then I've managed the household for all these years. My mom just kind of drinks and does her thing, and she's teaching school and, you know, partying with the school teachers, and I basically take care of my sister. And then he comes in, and it's like you got to ask to drink the Pepsi. You know, if there's Pepsi in the fridge, you need to ask before you drink it. Like, who does that? You know, you just drink it. Or you're going to go out, and maybe you're going to stay at a friend's house. Oh, whoops, I forgot to tell you. Sorry. So what happened was I started this, he would say things and I would disagree, and I would get in his face and disagree, and so he would just punch me, you know, like in the face. And so he would punch me and I would fall down, but I tend to be, you know, not happy about that, so I would just jump back up, and then he'd punch me again, and I'd fall down, and I'd jump back up, and he'd punch me again. It wasn't good, and I used to get beat up a lot, and I started running away from home. The first time I ran away from home, I was 13. I hitchhiked to Boston. And, you know, I would just drink, and there were a lot of outside issues. It was the 70s. I was there, I think. But I always drank. I am really a real alcoholic. I have always go alcohol is first and foremost and always. You know, and then if somebody else says, here, try this, okay, you know, whatever, what's it going to do? But it was always the alcohol. So I would drink, and then I would hitchhike. And I would drink, and I would hitchhike, and I would run away from home, and I would wake up in weird places, and then the police would find me, and they'd send me back home. Mr. B was 23. He got drafted. Vietnam was still going on. He didn't want to go in the Army, so he joined the Navy, and he became a naval officer because he was college degree. He went to OCS in Newport, and then we got stationed. And we went from Libertyville, Illinois, to New Orleans. And he became the officer in charge of the Officers Club, which was awesome because I had keys. So we moved to New Orleans, and I'm drinking. I've been drinking since I was 5. I moved to New Orleans, I think I've died and gone to heaven. So I'm drinking all the time. I go to school my first day, and it's 1971, and I come from Libertyville, and you need to really remember this. I come from Libertyville. I moved to New Orleans, 1971. They have just desegregated the schools. I go to school my first day, and the National Guard's there, and my mother said, oh, they must be doing some kind of military recruiting. I mean, we really had no idea. And my first day of school, I went in. The teachers load you up with books. After a while, you're walking down the hall, and you've got armloads of books. And a very nice young kid, another freshman, came up and asked me if I needed help carrying my books to my locker. And I, oh, thanks, you know, help me find my locker. And found my locker, stowed away my books, and then he took off to class. I didn't even get his name. When I left school that day, I got jumped and beat up by 3 black girls because he was a black kid. And apparently in the South in 1971, it's a real faux pas for a white person to talk to a black person in a just freshly desegregated school. But I didn't understand that. And I mean, I got the tar beat out of me that day by those 3 girls. And I go home, and my parents say, what did you do? You obviously did something. And I said, I didn't know what I did, but I figured I must have done something. You know, I don't fit in anywhere. And now I'm not fitting in to the point that I'm getting beat up. And I don't even know what it is that I did that got me beat up. So how do I stop doing it if I'm getting beat up? And I was petrified. So the next day I went to school. I rode the school bus to school, and I got off the school bus. And by the way, my school that I went to was like 3 blocks from the ferry. And you take the ferry across the river, and it drops you off at the French Quarter. So what I did was everybody went into school, and I just went to the ferry. And I just went downtown, and I hung out in the French Quarter all day. Yeehaw. So I continued, I would go to the French Quarter, and then, you know, you'd meet people, and things are going on in Jackson Square, and you're partying, and then you don't make it home, and then you wind up in Galveston or Houston or Iowa once, you know, like who wakes up in Iowa? But they had a freight yard there, and, you know, we'd jump on freight cars, you know, that's back when you could, you know, and so I come back, and the second very, very formative thing happens to me in my life. The police bring me home one time, and my parents say, there's something really wrong with you. We're really concerned. We're going to take you to a psychiatrist, and they're going to do an evaluation, and you're going to go to this little place, and you're going to spend 3 days so they can evaluate you. And I said, okay, whatever. And they took me to a place called DeBall's Mental Hospital on Audubon Park. Fancy joint, right? Fancy place. It's beautiful brick and all perfectly landscaped and gorgeous, and it's right off Audubon Park in New Orleans. Lovely place. And they brought me there. And they took me in for my 3-day evaluation. And I stayed for a year and a day. They wouldn't let me out. And the only reason that they let me out is because insurance ran out. I want to tell you a little bit about what it looks like on the inside of DePaul's mental institution in 1971. Have you ever seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? That's where I was. There were people tiptoeing around, and then they get shock therapy, and then they drool and Thorazine. I sat and ate dinner one night with this girl, Diane, and she excused herself to the bathroom, and I noticed the ketchup bottle was missing, and I ran into the bathroom as she busted it and sliced her throat wide open. They used to, if you didn't behave, they would put leather straps on me, leather straps on your wrists, and then they hook them together, and then they put leather straps on your ankles and hook them together, so you kind of shuffle down the hall like this, this whole thing's going to go, yeah, boom! At night, they strap you with leather straps to a cot, and you have to sleep in the hall, like under observation, strapped down. I was 14 when they put me in. and they strap you down in the hall. But here's the deal. If you share in group and you talk to your psychiatrist, mine was Remy Gonzalez. Seriously, that was his name. If you share with your psychiatrist and you're open and you're honest and you share in group and you cooperate, you start to get privileges. Like your levels go up and they unshackle you from the bed and they actually let you have a room with a roommate. And then eventually they take the shackles off your arms and your ankles. And then eventually, if you continue to be a really good girl and you really participate, they give you a day pass to the French Quarter. So yay! Right? So you get the day pass and you go to the French Quarter and then you disappear for 3 or 4 weeks. Amazing. And here's the thing. When you're a fugitive from a mental institution, you can do anything because you don't go to jail. You go back to the nut house. So you have a blast. Oh yeah, you go into stores, you just pick what clothes you want, walk out with them. Like, who cares? What are they going to do to you? And then you go back and then they shackle you and you're back on the bed with the straps and then you start behaving yourself and you work your way back up to a day pass. So that was my experience at DePaul's mental institution. So the day that they let me out, they call my parents in and we have the meeting. Mr. and Mrs. Brandel and Holly. And Holly's sitting on the couch and I got that attitude. You know how you do on the outside? You got that attitude like whatever. Only we didn't say that back then. And on the inside, you're petrified because you don't know what's going to happen. And this is what Remy tells my parents. Mr. and Mrs. Brandel, it's unfortunate that we have to release Holly today. She is a sociopath. I'm certified. And they ran down this list of all the labels du jour. You know, now everybody's bipolar. Back then we were sociopaths. You know, it's, you know, we all have our little diagnoses. But, you know, they ran through all these certified diagnoses that I am certifiably crazy. And they said, what you need to do is make funeral arrangements. Because she is going to die. Now I'm on the couch. This is a third person conversation. And I'm listening to this. And I'm 15. And I'm listening to this. And this prominent psychiatrist is telling my parents that I am terminally insane. That I am destined to live the life I've been living. I am destined to have no control over whatever happens to me. And it will eventually kill me. I'm not suicidal. But I will get myself in a position where someone murders me, or I just OD, or who knows what, but I'm going to die. And then they go, good luck. And out we go. I was 15. For the next 8 years, I proved them right. Because I thought, I believed it. I'm completely crazy. And I am. You don't believe me? Give me a glass of wine. I'll show you. If I put anything into my body, but nobody ever said that. Nobody ever said, maybe she shouldn't be drinking. They said, she's crazy. And I'm sure, having heard my history, they could say, well, you know, look how she, you know, was raised with that crazy daddy. And, oh, well, you know, it's done too much psychological damage to her when she was too little. When I was with my daddy and I was protecting him from the G-men and I was shooting guns and I was driving his cars and I was covering his back and taking care of him, I was 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 years old. Doesn't make sense to me. But I was. Now I'm raging, hitchhiking around the country. I wake up in places I don't want to wake up, and I wake up with people I don't want to be with. It's not fun. I don't hitchhike to LA and wake up in Malibu, you know? I wake up in Motel 6 with orange shag carpet stuck on the side of my face. You know, it's really not pleasant at all. I wake up in situations you don't want to wake up in, you know, where like you grab a sheet and try to get out before anybody else wakes up, you know, like really bad situations. In the midst of all that, I got married when I was 18. I actually got trashed on tequila one night with my boyfriend's best friend, and we got married. So my boyfriend wasn't happy, but oh well. After we got married, our parents, you know, like hooked us up with him with a job and an apartment and all this, so we decided to stay married because, you know, like it was paying off. We stayed married. Yeah, it was funny. He's being really nice to us. I had a daughter 2 years later, my daughter Casey. While I had my daughter, I went back to college. I actually got a GED and went to college in the midst of all this. I think we're really smart alcoholics, the ones that live. You know, I think that we have incredible survival skills. So I was able to knock out a GED one day and go to college. And so I was in college, and I did a thesis on natural childbirth when I was pregnant for my daughter. So I didn't drink or do anything because I, you know, was studying what it did. But I can assure you, after she was born, I breastfed for 2 months, and then I was off to the races. And when she was 9 months old, I went out for Mixer one night, and I didn't come back. I disappeared. And I was gone for 9 months, and I don't remember much of that 9 months. I know I have a scar right here on my face. I fell in a hotel in New Jersey and landed on a sink and broke some ribs and stole a car. But, you know, faint little memories of that, but not a lot. By the time my daughter was about 18 months old, my mother found me in Pittsburgh and brought me back to New Orleans and paid for an apartment and said, you've got to stay here. Your husband and your child need you. You know, get a psychiatrist, do something, but here, stay here. And so I did. I just kept doing what I was doing, but I didn't hitchhike anywhere. And I went out on February 2nd, 1981. I went out. I was out in a club, and some guy said, do you want some? And I said, yes, you know, don't even know what it was. And off I went following this guy out, and I ended up in a really, really bad situation out on a dock, and, you know, I was being attacked, and, you know, wasn't good, and I was going to be killed is what was going to happen, and I wasn't in a blackout. I remember it vividly, and I made eye contact with this guy as I was laying on the ground, and he was just, you know, and I said, please kill me. And it freaked him out, and he ran off and left me there. And I know I passed out for a while, but when I came to, I you know, kind of collected my clothes and made my way home. Hitchhiked home. I always wonder who gave me a ride, but, you know, I don't know. Somebody gave me a ride home. I don't know. And I called my mom that morning, and I said, Mom, I was mugged last night because I didn't know what else to say, and I really want to come home. And she had divorced Mr. B and was now married to an architect and had moved to Houston. And they had a pool. And I needed really to, I was a mess. And she said, go to the airport, there'll be a plane ticket. I flew to Houston. I get off the plane, and my mom doesn't say anything. I have 2 black eyes. My lips all busted. I have broken ribs. My hair's all matted. Some of it had gotten pulled out. I mean, I was like, didn't look very good at all. And it was like really obvious. She didn't say a thing. We're driving. She had a van. You know those custom vans, you know, with the little tables in the back, and they're all painted fancy and all that. She had one of those. She's driving over here, and I'm over there like, okay, let's just be cool. And she says, you're never going to believe this. And I said, what, Mom? And she said, I've been sober and Alcoholics Anonymous for 3 days. Woo! Right? Yeah, Mama's got the newcomer blinders on. She can't see anything but herself, which was good because I was a mess. And she says to me, you know, it would mean so much to me if you would come to a meeting with me tonight to support me. And she meant it. It was all about her. There were no innuendos. There was no, maybe she'll get something out of this, maybe she'll. She was 3 days sober. You know, she's still vibrating in her shoes. No offense to anyone that's 3 days sober. I'll be able to pick you out because you'll be dead. Anyway. So, of course, what I say to my mother is, oh, Mom, I'd be happy to go with you to support you because, I want to crash at her place. So that night, February 3rd, 1981, we go to a meeting in Kingwood, Texas, in a little trailer in the parking lot of the Episcopal Church. And we walk in, and it's a smoke-filled little trailer, and they start this meeting, and I'm checking it out. I'm listening. I'm paying attention because it's not for me. We all know Mom's an alcoholic. Mom drinks martinis. She cries. She falls asleep. That's what they do. Sometimes with a little help from a little Tylenol if I need the car, but other than that, you know, she... But, you know, that's what an alcoholic woman looks like. They drink, they cry, they fall asleep. So I sit there and I listen in the meeting, and out of the blue, across the room, this little old lady starts talking, and she says, I thought I was terminally insane. And I went, what? And she said, I used to go places I didn't want to go. I used to be with people I didn't want to be with. I used to break the hearts of the people I love time and time again, and I didn't want to. I made promises that I meant and I couldn't keep. I thought I was terminally insane. And then I found out that I'm not. That I have a disease, and that disease is alcoholism. And there's a reprieve. And she did that because, you know, the 12 steps were right there on the wall. And she went, and there's a reprieve. There's these steps. And if I work these steps, I don't ever have to feel like that again. And I was sitting in that chair and I went, oh my God. Oh, please let me be an alcoholic. Oh, I never wanted to be something so much in my life. You know, I don't understand when people say, well, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic. Or, you know, I don't want to be one. Really? Really? You don't know? You don't want to be one? Think about it. If you're an alcoholic, you have a disease. But if you're not an alcoholic, then everything that you do is doomed to be repeated. You're going to watch your parents cry. You're going to watch your children look at you with tear-streaked faces going, please stay home. You're going to watch employers say, you have so much potential, I have to let you go. You're going to go over and over and over with that. Or you can be an alcoholic. Woo! And there's hope. And there's a solution. I'm a proud card-carrying member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was fired up. At the end of the meeting, they did the chip thing, just like they do most everywhere, except it was a silver chip, and they called it a desire chip. And I ran up to the front of the room, and I got that desire chip, and I ran back, and I sat down, and I was like, I had hope for the first time in my life. Hope. I haven't had hope. I don't know that I'd ever had hope, ever. And I had it. And my mom leaned over and said, that's wonderful, honey, but if you want to go to a meeting tomorrow night, you need to get a ride because you're not using our car. Because their cars used to kind of wake up in other states, too. So how? Somebody is so excited about being an alcoholic, and I mean, I jumped in. I dove in. Both feet dove in. I ended up going to Hawaii in 1982, you know, because some guy came into a meeting and said, join me in paradise. And I said, okay, you know, and went to Hawaii in 1982. I was divorced by then. Might want to add that. I got a sponsor. I worked the program. I worked the steps. Crazy things happened to me. First thing, I got my first friend, my very first friend. Yes, he was invisible. He's called God. Actually, he was called Cherie's God at the time because my God was a little too strict, but hers was a hippie God, and he was super cool. But I got my very first invisible friend. I wasn't alone anymore. I carted that guy everywhere with me. Okay, Cherie's God, what are you going to do today? Show up. What are you doing? I don't believe it. And I started looking and talking, and I had a friend. And then I worked the steps because they make you do that here, you know. They'd like to suggest it, but, you know, you do it or you, like me, you're afraid they might ask you to leave if you don't. We don't, by the way, but I did them. And I did my fourth and my fifth step with a woman that I admired, a woman that I would tell you walked on water. She was the most coolest hippie chick, awesomest sponsor in the world. And I had to go tell her what a horrible, decrepit, horrible person that I was, knowing that she was going to find out who I was and never like me again, but I did it anyway. And you know what? She hugged me afterwards, and she looked me in the eye, and she said, I just love you. And I had my first human friend. And then she pushed me forward with 6 and 7, like, oh, my God, she can't fix it. She's nuts. He can. Thank God. That's 6 and 7, by the way. And then I did 8 and 9. And I ran around because I obviously realized what a complete nut job I was. And I was so excited to be able to go tell people that I don't plan on being a nut job anymore. And I'm really going to try to be different. And so I did 8 and 9. And when I did 8 and 9, all of a sudden, I got reunited with mankind. I could look people in the eye for the first time ever in my life. Like, look them in the eye. Not like defense, you know, like a cop an attitude, look them in the eye. But really look them in the eye. I could listen to people in a room and cry, and I don't even know them, but their story touches my heart. What? And I drank again. And I want to tell you why. The reason I drank again is because life gets good. If you do what you're told to do in this program, if you listen to your sponsor, if you work the steps, if you do service work, and if you do everything that's necessary, life gets good. I was a waif. I did not know how to sleep nights and get up during the day. I certainly didn't know how to work. I didn't know how to communicate with another human being when I got here. And a few years into sobriety in Houston, I was the senior administrator for a corporate international law firm. I worked in downtown Houston. I traveled to San Francisco all the time. I did young people's conferences all the time. They didn't have YPG back then. That's like new. But back then, you know, we were YPG, but, you know, they didn't have a label. But we did have young people's conferences, and, you know, I was really, really involved. And then I met a guy. My parents actually introduced us. They moved to Jacksonville in 1986, and I promptly came over in 88 to visit them. And they introduced me to a coworker of my dad's. So this is a pre-approved man. And ladies in the room, you know, when you get a pre-approved man from your parents, that's huge. And I met him, and I was doing everything in sobriety, and I wasn't dating, and but I was lonely. And I met this guy. He's not in the program. He's not an alcoholic. He's a button-up sweater guy. He's Florida Gator. There'll be some boos and hisses, but that's okay. Super, super nice guy, and he spoke French, so he had to be my soulmate. So, you know, I went back to Houston. We talked on the phone. I got engaged. I came back 6 months later and married him. What? I did tell him at one point that I had tried marijuana once and didn't like it. And that's it. Yeah. So I moved to Jacksonville, Florida. I get married. He has a daughter. I have a daughter. We decide to have two more children. I have two sons. So I have four children. I attend Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. There's a key word there. I attend Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I become Catholic because he's Catholic and it seemed like the thing to do. So I became Catholic. I taught CCD, which is Sunday School for Catholics. I taught CCD. It's just funny. I mean, really. But anyway. Yeah, you have to know me a little better before you really laugh. I was very, very involved in my family, in my community, and with my children. And I'm going to tell you why. I misunderstood the big book. And this is really important. It's such an important part of my story and for today. I misunderstood it. You know, I came in here and I was this girl that had no idea how to exist as a human being. And I thought what the big book said was, become a citizen. It's the best word that I can use for you. Become a citizen. Be a good employee. Be a good wife. Be a good daughter. Be a good mother. Be an active member of your church if you belong to one. Vote, for God's sake. You know, just do the, be a citizen. And so that's what I did. And I married a citizen. A button-up sweater guy that didn't drink and didn't have a history and had no friggin' clue. And his parents had been married forever. And God bless me, I had no idea we married. And how I knew I had a problem was right after we got married, I rode my bicycle to his office to surprise him for lunch. And the office was about 2.5 miles away. And when I got there, he said, oh my God, how'd you get here? And I said, I rode my bike. And he said, you rode your bike on Beach Boulevard? Oh my God, you could have been killed. I'm going to put your bike in the trunk, and we'll have lunch, and I'll drive you home. And I thought, oh, my God, I used to hitchhike around the United States. And I knew we had a problem. But what I also knew was, if he knew me, he wouldn't like me. He never interacted with me. We talked on the phone for 6 months, and I married him. But the big book says I'm supposed to be a citizen. I'm supposed to be these things, right? I'm not supposed to, you know, want to ride bikes on highways, and I'm not supposed to want to go skydiving. Oh, my God. You know, I'm not supposed to want to do things like that. I'm supposed to, you know, wear frumpy clothes and teach Sunday school and raise children and like it. And he would say things like, are you going to go to a meeting tonight, honey? Do you have to go? Because I really want you to stay home so we can watch videos with the children. Okay. And I said, oh, honey, I don't need a meeting tonight. So I'll stay home. And pretty soon I'm going to a meeting once a week, and then once a month, and then once every few months. And then by the time I'm 13 and a half years sober, I went to pick up a chip. We moved to Louisiana for 2 years for business, and we're moving back. And we had rented the house for a while, and they were finally buying it. And we had to go over and take things out of the attic and do the final cleanup of the house. And we were all done. Everything was finished. The house was empty. People were going to move in that bought the house. Everyone was gone. And I was thirsty. I had a thermos of coffee, and it was empty. And I was, you know, sweaty and been moving all day and thirsty. And I opened the refrigerator, and the only thing in it was a six-pack of beer we had bought for the movers, but nobody in our life drank. So it was still there. So I took the little lid off my thermos, the little lid on the top of the front. I reached in and I took out a beer and I opened it and I poured a little bit in my little thermos and threw the rest away, and sucked it down and walked out of the door and didn't give it a single thought. Not one thought. I didn't say, oh, that's alcohol. I didn't say, oh, you're going to blow a 13 and a half chip here. Maybe you should call your sponsor. Have you been to a meeting? Nothing crossed my mind. I was thirsty. I drank that little cup left, didn't think a thing of it. 6 months later, I'm out to dinner with my husband, and I said, you know, 6 months ago when we were moving out of the house, I drank a little beer, so I guess I blew the whole chip thing. Would you mind if I order a glass of wine? And he said, oh, no, that would be lovely. You've never been able to have a glass of wine with me before. Because I was 7 years sober when he met me. He had no clue. And thus began 1 year of controlled drinking. My youngest son saved my life. My youngest son was an infant at that time, and I was breastfeeding. And for anybody that doesn't know, when you're breastfeeding a child, you're only allowed to have 2 drinks, and then you have to wait about 3 hours. And that's what I did. I drank 2 drinks in about 30 seconds, and then I waited 3 hours. And then I drank 2 drinks, and I waited 3 hours. I'm here to tell you that I have a disease, and that disease is alcoholism. Untreated alcoholism is ugly. I am full of 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. I have an inability to form a true partnership with another human being. The weight of that tortured loneliness is so overbearing and so powerful that I can't stand it. And the only solution is alcohol. When I had 2 drinks, I got no solution. I was burdened with the weight and had the craving that occurs after the first drink and could not satiate it. It was horrifying. I know what alcoholism is, and I don't have to have a blackout or get wasted to have it. It was very clear to me with 1 year of controlled drinking what a tortured hell I was living in with no blackout, no drunk, nothing bad happened on the outside. The night that I was weaning my son from breastfeeding, we actually left town and we went back to that little village in Hawaii that I had gone to in 1982. Now, he'd never been there, but I just somehow planned the trip there. And we got off the plane, we went to the store, we bought all the things we needed for the condo, we're unloading alcohol. And it was like coming out of a blackout. It was a complete spiritual experience. He's unloading alcohol and I realized, oh my God, I have no reason to stop tonight because, you know, we didn't bring the kid. I said, throw it out. Throw it all out. Oh, my God, what have I been doing? And I ran out the front door and just left him standing there because I knew where the meetings were. I'd been there in 1982. Now it's 1996. And I ran, it was about 2 miles, and I ran to the little church where the meetings are, and I sat on the little step, and I sat there for 4 hours until it was time for the meeting. And I cried, and I thought, oh, my God. And I went into the meeting, and I got my white chip again. And that was February 28, 1996. I will never, ever, ever stop being in the middle of this program again. I live in a pocket of enthusiasm. I don't attend meetings. I'm involved. I'm involved in my home group. I have a sponsor. My sponsor's Polly P. I sponsor women. I have same 4 children. They're all grown now. The boys are in college. I have grandsons that are 20, 13, and 3. My life is full and amazing and wonderful, and that's scary as heck. The more amazing and wonderful it gets, the more I want to be right here in front of you guys or out there with you watching somebody else. I want to be here and I want to be in the middle because I never, ever, ever want to get thirsty again. Thank you so much for having me.